Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 21st, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And later this half hour, we'll get cash grain analysis from the folks at the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says the EPA has made some mistakes in dealing with agricultural issues. We'll have these and other stories. And in the second part of the show, the farming world, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with John Ashworth of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. It's all on the Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's check how prices fared on the settlements on this Wednesday afternoon. In Kansas City, September wheat settled at 601.5, up 12 on the day. December, 618.75, up 12.25. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade settled at 588.25, up 11.25. December, 618.75, up 11.75. March of 2011, 640.75, up 10.75 on the day. September corn settled at 379.75, up 5.75. December, 393.5, up 6. March, 406.25, up 6.25. May, 414.5, up 6.25. July, 421.5, up 6.25. August soybeans settled at 10.15.25, up 3.5. September, 9.90.5, up 3.75. November, 9.78.5, up 5.5. August soybean meal settled at 303.30, up 1.80. August soybean oil settled at 38.26, down 14. August live cattle settled at 93.50, up 37.5. August feeders settled at 114.65, up 17.5. August lean hogs settled at 81.50, up 147.5 on the day. And those are today's settlements in Kansas City and in Chicago.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says temperatures today through Saturday will continue in the upper 80s and lower to middle 90s across the lower parts of the Midwest from Missouri to Kentucky. Highs further north will be mostly in the 80s with a few lower 90s until Saturday and Sunday when readings cool to the 70s and 80s. Isolated to scattered showers will occur next week and temperatures will trend warmer again. Pockets of net drying will resume next week. Favorable subsoil moisture will maintain excellent crop development potential into the first week of August. And a high-pressure ridge is expected to develop aloft in the plains and far western Corn Belt at the end of this month and prevail in early August.
Lernard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Lernard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Looks to me like the wheat market was the leader today.
Yes, and it re-emphasized the focus of the problem. And there's major problems in dry weather in Argentina. Their crop is just getting planted, and of course, the spring wheat area of the new lands and Ukraine and Russia, wheat crop seems to be in trouble. But it's not only wheat; it's sunflower, soybeans. They bought a lot of new machinery and used machinery from the U.S. farmers, and a lot of U.S. investors have gone over there and are learning, teaching, and working and farming over there. So it's not the same old communist regime, but it is causing a lot of trouble. They sell a lot of feed grains, and our coarse grain balance sheet has changed. It's tightened up as a result of this major drought over there.
And then the wheat brought the corn market along, although corn has its own interesting story to tell. You know, over the weekend on Commodity Week, I was talking to the panel about old crop corn, and it was sort of my gut. I mean, I didn't have numbers in front of me to back it up, but just talking to producers, it was my gut that there's still an awful lot of bad old crop corn out there, and I kind of wondered, you know, how would the marketplace handle that?
Well, it is a topic that did reignite my interest after we talked about it. And, of course, that the Commodity Week's learning process for the people on there as well as the listeners. And it's not only a problem to the Ohio River clear up into the Illinois River and in the Midwest where there is a low test weight and kind of a corn crop that was kind of immature when it was harvested, and then it was a bad winter, so to speak, to keep it in condition. High moisture corn, low test weight. It is a problem, and when we ask what percent of the corn crop carryover is damaged, you know, I've heard anywhere from 10 to 50% of the carryover. I think it's more like 25%, and it's the damage discounts are very high. And it is a problem, and it's going to have to, a lot of corn is going to have to be carried over in the marketplace. Trouble with damaged corn, it's hard to keep. It does create shrink, and a lot of shrink. And as a result of that, I think that we are going to see the U.S. carryover be reduced as a result of that. And also, I think you're going to see two different bids out there, one for damaged corn and the other one for number two corn, and I think that will also show up as we go into the harvest time frame. One of the panel members from the Andersons brought out a good point as well. It's going to be an early harvest, and that's also going to help solve some of the problems, but it's still an enormous financial hit.
You know, if you're looking at 20 to 30%, you're looking at something along the lines of 260 to 390 million bushels. And you've got shipments promised of over 300 million bushels still on the books for this year. I just think it's going to be a very big technical issue, and you suggest that basis might work in favor of the producer along the way. Maybe the futures do, too. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, if somebody's there to stand delivery and has export shipments, you know, that could create some interesting a situation in the September corn. And it could create the spreads to tighten a little bit there. And also, if somebody needs a specialty company that needs number two corn, it's also going to create some interest for that market. So, yes, I think it's an appropriate subject, and it is. It's probably one of the largest carryovers of damaged corn that I can ever remember.
Turn our attention to the soybeans. November contract. It's just hovering around that 978 level, which is, you either look at it as a support or a resistance level, depending upon your point of view, but it just doesn't seem to want to move away from that point very much.
Yeah, I was a little surprised with the weather forecast for 10 days and the delta being hot, why the market even quivered and went down after the market opened this morning. Two things, I think. Some of the weather people are talking about a hurricane possibly coming up in the delta. That's way down the road. And number two, the crude oil market's weak. We've got the stock market down. And, of course, Chairman Bernanke's talking to the senators today about the U.S. economy, and you know, they're quizzing him about how many rabbits are left in the hat. The big factor here is, of course, when the crude oil broke, soybean oil broke, and when, as we went towards the close today, it did weaken up. But the soybean is a very strong performer. We've got tremendous demand by China. We've got a dry situation in the Delta. And as a result of that, we do probably have a smaller bean acreage because of preventive planting as well, haunting the marketplace.
And the outside market, the Dow, hanging around the 10,000 level, can't figure out what it wants to do next.
Well, you know, good. That's a good point. But the Dow weak, crude oil weak, and corn, soybeans, and wheat higher, it did show good divergence in the marketplace.
What else are you watching?
Well, I think the other factor that we're watching here is of course, the tighter carryover in the feed grains. And as a result of that, we are probably going to have to bid up for acres. And even with this miserable economy, it does probably augur well for farmers. We're not going to quite see the big sell-off that we were anticipating this fall. And that's good for farmers and better for their pocketbooks. And hopefully we'll get a little bit of support with some good ethanol blending power from the EPA.
Thank you, Paul.
Have a profitable day.
That's Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services, and he is in Oakland, Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack today defended Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson's handling of agricultural issues, but also acknowledged EPA has made some mistakes in handling farm issues, and he said he is trying to help farmers in their relationship with the agency. Vilsack says that he believes EPA officials do not get into the countryside enough and do not communicate well with farmers. Vilsack also said that he had found that when EPA analyzed the potential for corn-based ethanol as an alternative fuel in reducing carbon emissions, EPA did not understand that corn productivity had risen dramatically in the last 15 years. Shipments of U.S. corn destined for China's Dalian port are not expected to be affected by an oil pipeline explosion late last Friday that caused an oil spill in Chinese waters around the northern harbor. Cleanup in the Beijing section of the Dalian port, which handles grain shipments, is likely to take just 4 to 6 days. A new study from the National Resources Defense Council says that one-third of U.S. counties are facing a high risk that future water demand will outstrip supplies. The study reports that persistently parched grasslands, withering wheat and corn crops, and strained city utilities are a growing probability for 14 states seen at extreme risk of water shortages by 2050, including Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Texas. The study also says that in all, more than one-third of all counties in the lower 48 states are at high risk of water shortages by mid-century as climate change combines with growing population. California, Arizona, Nevada, and Colorado also made the list of severely water-threatened areas. The potential water shortage threatens $100 billion in crops. Ukrainian analysts today say that Ukraine, the world's largest barley exporter, is likely to reduce its barley exports by 18 to 23% in 2010-2011 after severe weather damaged crops. Analysts expect barley exports of between 4.8 million and 5 million tons in 2010-2011 after a fall in 2010 harvest of about 13%. Severe frosts in the 2010 winter, followed by record high temperatures in the summer, have damaged about 500,000 hectares of barley. Meanwhile, Ukraine's agriculture minister says today that Ukraine will not impose grain export limits in the 2010-2011 growing season. Russian agriculture officials today say that it will sell grain from its stocks to domestic animal and poultry breeders, as well as processors, to cushion damage from a severe drought. The ministry said it will sell over 3 million tons of feed and milling grain, representing about one-third of its intervention stocks. The state grain trader, the United Grain Company, will start selling grain at tenders beginning on August 4th. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. The 1995 Freedom to Farm legislation adopted by the U.S. Congress discarded many of the restrictions that had previously caused farmers not to change crops. Under it, and farm bills since that time, producers have been able to participate in the farm programs and still make their own cropping choices. A University of Illinois study has looked at how acreage patterns have shifted in the United States since Freedom to Farm. Todd Gleason has the details.
The 1995 Freedom to Farm Act gave producers the option to plant what they believed to be their most competitive crops and still participate in the farm program. That choice tenet still underlies today's farm bill legislation, and when comparing the five-year period just before its enactment to the last 5 years, 2005, 6, 7, 8, and 9, there are clear-cut winners and losers in terms of crops and acreage, says University of Illinois farm management specialist Gary Schnitke.
What we saw is a movement towards soybeans and corn. And soybeans gained 14 million acres from the early period to 2005 to 2009. Corn gained 9 million. So those two crops were the only crops that gained in acres. The other crops, hay and rice, were stable. But the big losers were wheat, barley, and grain sorghum.
Again, when comparing the era from 1990 to 94 to 2005 to 2009, soybeans and corn grew in acres. Crops losing acres were wheat, barley, and grain sorghum, along with corn silage, cotton, peanuts, dry edible beans, and potatoes. To evaluate acreage changes, data detailing acres harvested in the United States by year were obtained from the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Data were collected for all crops with over 1 million acres harvested in 2008. There were 13 of them: soybeans, corn for grain, hay, rice, wheat, barley, grain sorghum, corn for silage, cotton, peanuts, dry edible beans, potatoes, and sugar beets. Acres harvested were averaged for the years 1990 through 94, the years preceding the passage of the 1995 Farm Bill, and 2005 through 2009. Between the early 90s and the late 2000s, soybeans were the crop with the largest acreage increase. It averaged 58.2 million acres harvested in the early 1990s, increasing to 72.2 million acres in the late 2000s. It's a 14 million acre increase, or about 25%. Corn also had a sizable increase of 9.4 million acres, or about 14% from one period to the other. Wheat had the largest reduction, from 62.8 million acres to 50.7 million acres, or down 19%. The data, says Schnitke, shows the largest increases in corn and soybean acreages were concentrated in the Great Plains and the greater Corn Belt.
The state that gained the most in corn and soybean acres was North Dakota, gained 4 million acres. And other big gainers were Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas.
Again, the commodities with the largest gains over the period pre- and post-Freedom to Farm were soybean and corn. Wheat, barley, grain sorghum, corn for silage, and cotton experienced the largest losses. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now with Cash Grain Analysis is Matt Kunisch of the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon.
We've been having a discussion earlier this afternoon on the air about damaged old crop corn, and we were thinking that if the old crop carry is 1.3 billion bushels and you sort of say, well, maybe ballparking it, the old crop damage is between 20 and 30%. You come up with something like 260 to 390 million bushels. And then you begin to think, how is the market going to handle this glut of old crop corn around harvest? What do you think?
Well, it's going to be a logistics nightmare. We have been looking into that for about 3 weeks now. Right now, our facilities don't really have a shot at getting that out before harvest, carrying quite a bit of wheat, and the damaged corn is going to be a challenge at harvest. Beans are going to be shipped out basically as soon as they hit the door, and holding on to corn, definitely going to have to sell quite a bit more of the early corn in harvest than what we would definitely like to, but right now, no other choice. In Delphi, we are pulling damage from 60, 70 miles away only because we are still accepting of it. So,
do you think that there might be two basis bids, one for good number one or two corn and one for number three corn?
Yes, and I would say that to some extent we are already seeing that. However, with the better bid for the number one, it is scarce. Number two corn, it is scarce to find the sub-5 damaged corn to blend with the 30 to 60% that's coming through the door.
The other issue about this is there's still a bunch of corn that has to be shipped export-wise, over 300 million bushels.
Absolutely. We're having a hard time. Just the facilities finding it for export is going to be extremely difficult. I do believe it is out there, but getting it to move, I don't know which number you get to move at, because more and more producers are having to blend their own now, their own good corn with the damaged corn to even get it out of their own facility to make room for them for harvest. I think it could be a logistical nightmare for producers and for elevators, much like last year, except last year was obviously the moisture. So,
Matt, let's go ahead and get your bids today.
Climbers corn tonight going to close 373 cash. Delphi beans at 1028. And Delphi corn at 368.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Kunisch of the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. And in 2 minutes, I will be back with a look at the agricultural weather with meteorologist Drew Lerner. Stay tuned. It's Junk Food Day. What constitutes junk food is often in the eye of the beholder. What constitutes unhealthy food includes elements of cultural influences, class snobbery, and moral judgment, and, of course, quantitative measurements such as calories. On this day in agricultural history in 1694, George Brandt was born. Brandt, a Swedish chemist, discovered cobalt, which is added to steel to make it harder and have a higher melting point. Cobalt is also an essential part of vitamin B12. In 1873, it rained ants in Nancy, France. In 1917, the U.S. Senate voted on a food bill that, among other things, fixed the minimum price for wheat of $1.50 a bushel. In 1983, a new low record temperature was recorded at Vostok Station, Antarctica, minus 128.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And in 2006, the U.S. Senate voted after 2 days of emotional debate to expand federal funding of embryonic stem cell research, sending the measure to President George Bush for a promised veto. And that's this day in agricultural history. Listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Good afternoon, Drew.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, the ridge is a thing of the past, at least over much of the Corn Belt. I imagine it might be drifting out west some.
Well, there is going to be a new one that will be in the plains and catch maybe the western fringes of the Corn Belt in about a week. Late next week, we should see this feature develop. And it will likely not be a real strong feature initially. But we're seeing some changes take place around the northern hemisphere right now that actually would help to reinforce the potential for this particular ridge. You know, we've had a lot of ridges advertised in past weeks here, but we really never got a really well-defined high-pressure ridge that's set on top of us. Well, the conditions might be a little bit better for one to develop in the plains as we move into the last days of July and early August. There's nothing at the moment that would just have a huge negative impact potentially on the Corn Belt, but we are going to watch this next ridge a little bit more closely with a little bit different attitude than we've had in the past, just simply because conditions are a little bit more supportive of some kind of a ridge to develop out there and kind of hang out for a while. But for the heart of the Midwest right here at home, I don't think there's going to be a tremendous amount of worry for a while, especially after the big soaking rains that occurred in central Illinois here this week. But there are other areas in the Eastern Belt that are drying out, and we do need to see greater rains. Some of those areas include the extreme southern tip of Illinois and western Kentucky. Another area would be from northern Illinois over to parts of northern Ohio and southern Michigan. Now, some of this region I just mentioned will be getting rain over the next couple of days.
And temperatures will be seasonable for the next several days?
I do believe they will be, except in the south. Some of the southern parts of the region, if we drew a line from maybe coming out of Columbia, Missouri, over through the Indianapolis area and to Cincinnati, Ohio, and everything south of that line, we'll probably get into the lower middle 90s still for another 2 to maybe 3 days, and then we'll see a cool front come down over the weekend that will push all the 90-degree heat down into the lower parts of the country, and we'll see temperatures mostly in the 80s across the region. A couple of lower 90s are still possible, but nothing quite that warm. And as we go into next week, when that ridge starts to build up in the plains, we'll probably try to get a little bit warmer across the region again. But no excessive heat is expected, at least for the next 7 days.
So I guess when it's all said and done, there might be just a few pockets of net drying over the next week to 10 days.
I think that is true. We are going to watch this first 48-hour period of rainfall potentially, because if we don't get a decent amount of rain to fall across northern Illinois into northern Ohio and southern Michigan, then that particular area will become our region of concern for a little while, since parts of that region have been rather dry this month. There's no area of critical dryness out there, but if for some reason we do miss this event, things could change just a little bit in those areas. But the rest of the belt, I think, looks pretty darn good, and yeah, I don't think we have much to worry about for at least about a 10-day period here.
Thanks, Drew.
Have a great afternoon.
Meteorologist Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated. You've been listening to The Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey.
This is the Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk about next-generation renewable energy sources. John Ashworth is here to discuss the work of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The NRL is the nation's primary lab for renewable energy and energy efficiency research and development. The lab is located in Golden, Colorado. Mr. Ashworth, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Can you tell me a bit about the lab and its background?
We were created in 1977. The laboratory originally started out as the Solar Energy Research Institute, so obviously it was initially working on primarily on solar energy, but it quickly diversified off into a whole full range of renewable energy technologies. We're about 1,700 people. Biomass conversion, which is the area where I work, is the second largest part of the laboratory. We still have a large research program in solar conversion. Biomass is the next largest area. It's got about 140 full-time researchers and postdocs working here. And we work on all the ways that you can convert biomass into fuel. So biochemical conversion, which is fermentation, primarily, thermochemical conversion, which is high temperature processes for taking material, making it into a gas, and then converting the gas or the liquid into a fuel. And then we restarted our program on algae conversion. So we are working on how do you take algae and make it into a fuel that can be put into a car or into a tractor or things like that.
Is it a government agency?
We are funded by the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, I am not an employee of the Department of Energy. We are run by Battelle Research and by the Midwest Research Institute, but the funding is primarily from the Department of Energy. We also do have funding from industrial partners, but, you know, 90 to 95% of the funding is from the federal government.
95% of the funding comes from the federal government, and who do you partner with?
Primarily, we partner with people we partner with universities. We also partner with companies who are looking to develop new technologies or to test new technologies before they go out into the marketplace. Part of our job is to reduce risk. Part of what we do is we're an applied laboratory, so we're not just doing kind of fundamental research on this is the nature of the universe. We're really looking to develop technologies and methodologies that can be applied to making fuels. So in our case, transportation fuels. And we work with companies, they have an idea, they've developed the technology to a certain point. We can help them scale up that technology, figure out what is working, what's not working, what needs to be changed, before they go out and try to raise money to, you know, take it out into the marketplace.
I may have jumped ahead of myself. Do you do research on your own without partners as well? I may have jumped ahead.
No, that's fine. The answer is yes. We have a basic research program, and that research program primarily is focused on converting non-food biomass into fuels. So making cellulosic ethanol from corn stover, wheat straw, switchgrass, wood chips. We've probably been the leading center in the world in that area since the early 1980s. And we have a pilot plant here, two pilot plants, as a matter of fact, where you can scale up those technologies to, say, a ton a day of material coming in the door. and all the pieces that go along with that process, you know, we can do.
So let's talk more about this type of research. This is second-generation biofuels, meaning that it's not looking, as you said, at the seed. And in this case, we're used in our part of the world of talking about ethanol produced from corn or the corn seed. But you're talking about taking the plant itself as opposed to the corn, harvesting
Correct.
The corn, using it for feed or other products, and then taking the plant, what you would call the stover, or the cellulosic part, and converting that into energy. It was something that quite some time ago we thought would be 5 years away and hasn't really come to fruition at this point. How close are we?
We're getting pretty close. Our best estimate, the way we try to we try to calculate cost. Everything we do here is based on not on cost. And our best estimate is that if you started with corn stover today and you paid the farmer for the corn stover, so you're not getting it for free, and you built a 2,000-ton-a-day plant to convert that corn stover to ethanol, that ethanol would cost you about $2.40 per gallon today. Still too expensive unless the price of oil goes way back up. But we're thinking that within the next 2 years, we can get the price down to about $1.50 per gallon. And at that price, including the capital cost, including the operating cost, including a small profit margin for the operator of the factory, so at that cost, it would be cost competitive with oil at $70 a barrel. And since oil is currently $86 a barrel, life would be good. So we think within the next 2 years, the technology that's out there will start coming online. There will be several medium-sized plants that should be up and running by 2012 using some of the technology that was developed here but also developed, you know, by companies themselves. So, and we think once somebody demonstrates it, the investment capital will become, you know, readily available and people will start building factories. So we see this as a 2-3-4 year process before a lot of these come online. There are 23 cellulosic ethanol plants that are either in the design or construct phase. A number of these are small, so they're pilot, somebody trying to prove a process, a concept. Some of them are larger. There's several at 700 tons a day that have actually gone through the permitting process and are getting ready to start construction. Actually, one of them has started construction, the others will start this summer. So it's getting there. And then in addition to that, there are other technologies that are further out that are more third-generation technology, so people who are looking not to make ethanol, but to make something like jet fuel, or making diesel fuel, or making gasoline directly from biomass. So those are a little bit further out, but there's a lot of people raising a lot of money to build those facilities.
Now, one of the expertise that I read in our EL claims it brings to the table, and you talked a bit about it, was your modeling expertise, and mm-hmm. I think you call it techno-economics. Can you explain yes. something about that?
Yeah. One of the things we learned a long time ago is that it's not enough to say that a technology works. You have to understand how the economics bear out in a large-scale setting. So about 10 years ago, we took some standard industrial modeling software. It's used by companies like DuPont and Dow Chemical and people like that to do their process modeling when they build a factory. So this is standard industrial software. And what we did is we developed models for all the conversion processes that you use to start from, say, a piece of wood and go, or a piece of corn stover and go to ethanol, whether it's thermochemical or biochemical. And it looks at all the mass and heat energy that's being moved around inside the factory and tries to understand where it goes. So you can't cheat on this software. It doesn't let you. And then we attach real costs from real marketplaces. So we go out to vendors and say, if we bought a piece of a grinder from you, what would you charge us for a piece of grinder that's this big? And then we put that into the model. We run the factory for a year in the model, and then it says, okay, what does the fuel end up costing? you've bought the capital, you have to pay the bank off for the capital, you have to have operating costs, you buy the feedstock, you have to clean up the wastewater, all the things that are normal with operating a factory. And then we just use that and we back calculate the cost of the fuel. And what we do every time we do a research project here, before we do it, we run the model and we say, okay, if this research project increases the efficiency of the conversion from 80% to 85%, what does that do to the cost of ethanol? Does it get us to closer to our targets? If so, then we can do the research. If it doesn't get us closer, we don't do it. So the whole point is drive down the cost.
So your research is really applied and not the basic type of research that would need to be done to explore really the newest technologies or those that are just that haven't been developed yet or haven't been thought of yet. Is that right?
Well, we do some of that basic research, and we do it in order to feed into the more applied. So the best example is enzymes. When you break down some material like switchgrass or wheat straw or stover, you have to break apart these long chains of material down into simple sugars so the organism can eat them. The way you do that is with enzymes. The issue is nobody really understood how enzymes work, the actual mechanics of how they do their job. It's an amazingly complex process, and it's a biological process developed over millions of years. So we actually have tools here at the laboratory which allow us to go down almost to the atomic level, but certainly to the molecular level, where we can watch how the enzymes are working, and then we can make recommendations to enzyme companies about how to improve their enzymes because we understand better the actual mechanics of how these proteins are working in real time. And by doing that, we've been able to help the enzyme companies greatly increase the efficiency of their enzymes, which has made them cheaper. So, you know, the goal is to make it cheaper, but some of the science that goes into this is extremely high-tech and advanced, but the goal is always the same. The goal is always to get the materials and the processes less expensive.
The enzymes are difficult because oftentimes what they end up producing is, well, deadly to the enzyme?
No, enzymes are difficult because they were developed by organisms, usually fungi or things like that, in order for them to, you know, to eat. So, you know, I always tell people, if you think of, you take a tree and it falls in the forest, and you come back 20 years later, the part of the tree is gone. And the reason that tree is gone is that naturally occurring organisms in the forest have the ability to break down wood and eat it. And what they do is they make enzymes. Well, they do that very slowly. So it takes 20 years for a tree to break down in the forest. We're trying to break down these materials in 2 days. So you need enzymes that go much faster than the traditional, you know, enzymes did in nature. And that's what enzyme companies do. They try to figure out how to speed up the enzymes, how to make the organisms produce more of them. And when they do produce them, they work better. And so what we try to do is support that. And it's just complex proteins, you know, and those proteins are naturally occurring, but now they might work 100 times faster than they did in the wild. So the idea is we can help that process along, and by doing so, the enzyme companies will scale up their technology, they'll make more of it, they'll make it cheaper, and so that enables people who want to build a factory to make a less expensive fuel.
This afternoon, we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, former U.S. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and Tiger Management founder Julian Robertson have joined a growing chorus calling for the U.S. estate tax, which expired last year, to be reinstated by Congress before its August recess. Last week, Senator Blanche Lincoln and Senator John Kyle reintroduced a proposal to reinstate the estate tax applicable to fortunes of more than $5 million at a rate of 35% starting next year. Also last week, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus questioned whether the U.S. could afford to extend tax credits for the wealthy. Without action, the tax rate will rise to 55% with an exemption level of $1 million in 2011. The Italian automaker Fiat, which controls Chrysler, today reported a return to second quarter profits on improved sales of agricultural equipment and trucks and said it may raise its 2010 forecast. Fiat reported a second quarter net profit of $115.6 million. And Coca-Cola Company's second quarter net income climbed 16% as the world's largest drink maker said it sold more soft drinks and juices in every part of the world except Europe. The Atlanta-based maker of Coke and Sprite left its 2010 guidance unchanged today. The company said it earned $2.37 billion, or $1.02 per share, in the 3 months ending July 2nd. In the same period last year, Coca-Cola earned $2.40 billion, or 88 cents a share. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Mr. Ashworth, when we left, you were discussing enzymes and risk involved in all the kinds of things that have to do with second-generation fuels. We haven't taken up really, I think, maybe what is the point of the NREL, which is to help companies avoid some of the financial risk that comes along with developing these types of products. How do you do that?
Well, let me give you an example. Maybe that would be helpful. If you want to build a large-scale cellulosic ethanol plant today, using today's technology, that plant will cost anywhere from $300 million to $500 million. Whereas a corn ethanol plant today costs a 50-million gallon plant would cost $100 million. A 100-million gallon plant would cost $200 million. So these plants would be more expensive initially because of the capital. Bankers and other people are not willing to invest that kind of money unless they know that the technology works and it works at scale. So what we do here is we work with companies as they're developing technology and we help them scale it up. So if somebody is developing a new approach, they might be operating it in their laboratory at, say, 10-liter scale, which is 2.5 gallons. Okay, that doesn't mean much to a banker. So we have the ability here to scale that technology up first to 100 liters. We have 100-liter fermenters here. We can look at them, make suggestions, help people out with their approach, make it more efficient. Then we can scale it up to, say, 1,000 liters. Again, we have that in-house. And then we can scale it up to 10,000 liters, which is 2,500 gallons. And at that point, you're beginning to run into the real issues that you run into when you run a factory. The mixing issues, the, you know, transporting the material from point A to point B, moving it around. And so at that scale, you are really beginning to get data that's important. Because when you get to that scale, then you can take that money to an investor and say, see, the technology works. We're getting 75 gallons per ton of raw material. We've tried out different raw materials. The process works on different raw materials. NREL scientists have validated these numbers. They can tell you these are real. And then we can calculate out our best guess of what the cost of the production is. We're not going to get it perfectly right. But so that's how we help. We're really good at the engineering part of understanding how to do this. Sometimes you're working with companies that are very good at the biology part. They understand how a microorganism works, or they have a very good enzyme, or you're dealing with the people who develop the feedstock. So, for example, there's a number of people right now who are developing new crops out there designed specifically for making fuels. So we recently had a large, very successful project with the National Sorghum Producers where they were looking at different varieties of sorghum and trying to understand if they would be easily converted into ethanol. Not grain sorghum necessarily, but other kinds of sorghum like forage sorghum, sweet sorghum. So we brought these things into our facility here. We tested them. We fermented them at small scales. We ran them through our pretreatment reactors. And then we ran a one-ton-a-day run of one of the more promising materials, and we calculated out the yields and the costs. And this is a really good feedstock. So, you know, we basically now enable people who are interested in developing one of these plants to have an additional feedstock that they hadn't thought about before. So this would be like forage sorghum.
So
go ahead.
So what you do in general is you provide the risk capital for the development of the technology, but not the development, not the capital to put up a plant. Is that correct?
Well, we develop the risk expertise rather than the capital. Sometimes the Department of Energy pays for some of these studies. Sometimes the company themselves pays for these studies. But what we're really good at is doing the work. We've done this for 20 years. We know how to do it. So somebody can come in here and very quickly understand what is right and wrong with their process, where areas they have to improve. In some cases, we can develop that process for them, or we can work with their scientists or their engineers to develop that. So we're really more trying to help industry. There's a famous expression called the valley of death in technology, and it means that you get the technology to a certain stage, and then you don't know what to do from there, and you run out of money, and you disappear. What we're trying to do is help companies across that valley of death so they can get to the point where they can prove their technology at a large enough scale that they can get funding to build a commercial plant.
Mr. Ashworth, thank you so much for your time today. We do appreciate you talking about the National Renewable Energy Laboratory with us.
My pleasure.
John Ashworth is a team leader for NREL's Bioenergy Center. He joined us from his Golden, Colorado office. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. You've been listening to The Farming World, our latest offering on AM 580, as well as willag.org. If you would like to listen to this program again, go to willag.org and page down to the audio tab. Click on that and page down to the closing market report, where it is the back end of that show. While there, you can also subscribe to our weekly agricultural e-letter. To do so, just click on the right navigation window on the subscribe link. It's the WILL Ag e-letter, and you can subscribe to it by clicking on the navigation link at willag.org.